Library in Sacramento. He's written extensively on the California Gold Rush, including The California Gold Rush, a descriptive bibliography of books and pamphlets covering the years 1848 to 1853. You have mail, reading and writing during the Golden Era, and rooted in barbarous soil, popular culture on the Golden Shore. This La Cañada California native received degrees in history and library science in the University of San Diego and University of Southern California. Previously, Gary held positions as head librarian at the Sutro Library, California Historical Society Library Director, and bibliographer of Western Americana at the Henry E. Huntington Library. Currently, he serves as executive director of the California State Library Foundation and has been in charge of the publication program of the Book Club of California since 1987. He's an authority on the California Gold Rush and one of the most knowledgeable people in the state on resources pertaining to California history. This evening, he'll be speaking on how the Gold Rush legacy and Cornish heritage have shaped California.
Julie has a long drive. She's headed off to the Southern Mines and will be there in about 3 hours. Great privilege to work for a place like the California State Library, and it's interesting that I started my tenure there under Jerry Brown, who's known as Governor Moonbeam, and I'll finish my career there under the Governator. Little did I think that when I was watching that movie, Conan the Barbarian, that that'd be my future boss. It just shows you the opportunity of our glittering golden state. Just excited and delighted to be here in Grass Valley. It's one of my favorite places to be. Both my wife and I are raging biblioholics, bibliomaniacs, and of course we had to leave some money here in the local economy. There's several wonderful bookstores here, and we saw some things we just could not resist. We came back with an armload of books. It's one of the dangers of coming up here. But it's good here to be at what used to be called the Bad Dry Diggins and to participate in this wonderful gathering of Cousin Jackson, Cousin Jenny. And I love being here again in Grass Valley because it is home of some of my favorite people. Lola Montez, that alluring and beguiling actress who bedazzled the miners with her spider dance. And then there was the picturesque writer, that great bulbous nose known as Old Block, Alonzo Delano. Josiah Royce, California's first philosopher prince. Royce Hall at UCLA is named in his honor. The local branch of the public library carries Royce family name. And also my wife and I paid our respects this afternoon at the grave of John Roland Ridge, a Cherokee poet and journalist, wrote the first sensational book about California, The Life and Adventures of Joaquin Murrieta, the celebrated bandit chief. James Wilson Marshall in his autobiography reminisce. He said, "One morning in January, it's a cold, clear morning. I shall never forget that morning. Taking my usual walk along the race after the water had been shut off, my eye was caught with a glimpse of something shining in the ditch. I reached my hand down. It made my heart thump, for I was certain that it was gold. When he discovered that glorious nugget at Coloma 161 years ago, he not only set off a worldwide rush California, but touched off, in my opinion, the greatest artistic and writing frenzy in California and maybe the nation's history. Newspapers, guidebooks, maps, diaries, and letters all spread the word about a land where golden dreams could be realized. Artists drew paintings and illustrations and books and letter sheets gave visual meaning to this new El Dorado. And having worked for 3 institutions that specialize in California history, I am convinced more than ever that the California Gold Rush stands as our most compelling event. And as one person noted from Missouri, suffering from a raging case of gold fever, said all of creation appeared to be in an upheaval. Nothing had been seen like it since the Israelites left ancient Egypt. John Haskell Kemble, one of our great maritime historians, said, "There's no way to be sure about the migration to California in 1849 and 1850s. May have been recorded by more participants than any other mass movement in human history." What a statement. As Carl Wheat, the great map bibliographer, said, that the gold rush in terms of printer's ink has seldom been matched. And its variety and appeal, this Vesuvian event in our history cannot be beat. When I see the constant, never-ending stream of new publications on the subject, the number of letters and diaries that continue to be discovered, I have no doubt that Jim Marshall's great find continues to live on with anyone who has the collector's bug. And when you go to or wants to relive those rambunctious days of 49, like that distinguished organization called E. Clampus Vitus does, I'll say the brethren, virtually every book and paper show I go to has Bull Rush books, letters, and pictures. And you come here in May to that great Bull Rush book fair over here at the fairgrounds, and there's all kinds of temptations in front of you. So instead of gold nuggets, we now have books and pictures about gold nuggets, fetching the most astonishing prices on eBay and auction houses in San Francisco, even in this economically challenging time. It seems that there is gold, and then there are books and letters. Perhaps this should not be surprising, as the gold rush is such an incredible pageant filled with such human interest stories, enveloped with so much mythology, and recorded with such amazing documentation, that it will forever seduce the collector, the librarian, the curator, and the historian. I heard that siren call. I resisted at first, thinking the gold rush had been beaten to death. What more can you say? But then I succumbed. Henry Bigler, who was with Marshall on that fateful January 24th in 1848, said, "I have gold badly on the brain." I still have gold badly on my brain. The gold rush stands as California's defining event, and for this reason, it cannot be ignored. The gold rush marked the beginning of America's and the world's fascination with our golden state. Golden dreams became the American dream. It helped reshape the world at a time when revolutions from China to Europe upset the status quo. It was the year of the great potato blight. It's interesting to remember that Marshall discovered gold the same year that Karl Marx published the Communist Manifesto. And Marx wrote in 1849, "The dreams of gold had replaced the dreams of socialism." An English guidebook from the same year said that even if there is no gold in California, go there anyway. Your life will improve. As we all know, the sons of Cornwall did hear that siren call. Somehow, mining for gold had more appeal than mining for tin and copper. After all, in 1852, the peak year of the run for gold, nearly 4 million ounces of gold were discovered in these hills. And as the late Jim Holliday loved to point out, the gold rush marked a brief era in our history when no one said no. The 49ers are away from their ministers, their rabbis and priests, away from the watchful eyes of their mothers and wives, away from the stern stares of their fathers, away from government regulators, away from the humdrum life of plowing fields or shoveling coal or mining a shaft. In short, there is no one there to say, "You can't do that." Furthermore, the discovery took place at a time when the government was helpless to control events. Even the soldiers and sailors deserted their ships and posts. And yet yellow nuggets were there simply to be picked up. So this unparalleled freedom did have a downside, as we've learned in some more modern interpretations of the gold rush, the destruction of the Native Americans, destruction of some of the environment was a terrible price to pay. Nonetheless, gold was there, and to get it while it was getting was good. But how could you blame young, vigorous men for wanting to take a chance on California? When U.S. government appeared, and the newspaper reports appeared in the newspapers around the globe with words like these: "Gold is to be found in almost every locality, on the lands, on the mountains, in the valleys and rocks and streams and rivers, gullies and holes. In fact, almost everywhere, that the extent of the gold region may safely be estimated at not less than 500 miles by 150 miles. And it's capable of employing 200,000 people for centuries to come." And they did. This is at a time, too, when a skilled worker earned $300 in a place like New York City. If you were a cooper or a blacksmith, had a profession, that's what you made, maybe a dollar a day. They could make that tax-free here in California one day, and some even in 1 hour. As I worked on my Gold Rush book of eyewitness accounts, I became more and more captivated by the words of the gold rushers. Their words became my pile of gold. Every time I read one of the journals or letters, I had that sense of discovery that Marshall did. Sometimes my heart would thump. I would say, "This is just incredibly good reading." Their words glittered. Many possessed exceptional powers of description. The ability to express complex philosophical thoughts. And the gift to record what they saw with drama, emotion on occasion, with humor. For their words, for me, their words became that great irresistible magnet. Take, for example, how James H. Carson of Old Tule Bird, better known today as Stockton, recalled his case of gold fever. Said upon hearing the discovery of gold in the foothills of the Sierra, Carson, then an Army sergeant stationed at Monterey, deserted his post and wrote, "A frenzy seized my soul. Unbidden, my legs performed some entirely new movements of polka steps. Piles of gold rose before me at every step, castles of marble dazzling the eye with the rich appliances, thousands of slaves bowing to my beck and call. Myriads of fair virgins contending with each other for my love were among the fancies of my fervid imagination. The Rothschilds, Gerards, and Astors were but to me poor people. So 1 hour after I thus became affected, I was mounted on an old mule, armed with a washhand basin, a fire shovel, a piece of square iron pointed at one end, a blanket, a rifle, a few yards of jerked beef, and going at high pressure mule speed for the diggings." How do you resist words like that? Also wanted to share with you the magic that seemed to be surrounding the gold hunting at that time period. The touch of King Midas seemed to be everywhere and helped create a folklore and history that provided inspiration for authors for generations to come, including Bret Hart with his Luck of the Roaring Camp and Mark Twain with his very first book, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. Major William Downey of Downeyville fame, up the river here, up the road here, in his classic book, Hunting for Gold, wrote, "While we were camped on Jersey Flat, we caught a monster salmon weighing nearly 14 pounds. We boiled the fish in the camp kettle, and afterwards, when we examined the water, we found gold at the bottom of the kettle." Dolly Bates, who wrote one of the finest travel books on California, preserved this astonishing scene at a woman's boarding house in Downeyville. One day, as she was sweeping her floor, which, by the way, was nothing but earth, she saw something glitter. Upon examination, it proved to be a lump of gold. She searched further and found the earth was full of particles of gold. She immediately summoned her friend. They removed the table, benches, and stove. Upon the last named utensil was a dinner in progress. Who would think of preparing dinner, even if it were near the dinner hour, should they find themselves in possession of such rich diggings? That day, they took out from her kitchen floor, as she termed it, $500, mostly in lumps. Every day witnessed similar success. Just to translate that $500 adjusted for inflation, it would be worth about $12,500. Not bad for a day. Elizabeth Gunn of Sonora tells us of the wonderful effect of rain. Writing to her mother on the day after Christmas in 1851, she remarked, "You would be surprised to see men in rubber coats with umbrellas picking up the gold which is washed out of the earth by the rain." You probably have seen in the Sonora Herald the account of a man who, after a rain, stubbed his toe against a stone and found gold in quartz worth $800. Better than hitting the lottery, I think. Right here in Grass Valley, there's the story of a George Knight. I've read several different accounts. Or is it a George McKnight? Who went looking for a wayward cow in the wilderness around Grass Valley and stubbed his toe so hard that he broke loose a chunk of white rock. Despite the pain, he examined it and recognized that this piece of quartz was seamed and veined with gold. The area became known as Gold Hill, and this great development became the beginnings of the great mines that brought out the Cornish here to Grass Valley. But no one seemed to know whatever happened to this cow. And our friend James Carson, writing again for the San Joaquin Republican in 1852, contributed further to the lore of the diggings. He tells the tale of a miner's funeral in 1848, officiated by a preacher who had drunk a little bit too generously to the soul of the deceased. Carson reported that the parson had been praying some 10 minutes when some of the miners, kneeling around the grave, began examining the dirt they had dug up, found it, as they expressed it, to be lousy with gold. Discovery, not surprisingly, caused much excitement at this funeral. The tipsy preacher tentatively opened one eye and exclaimed, "Boys, what's that? By God, it's gold, the richest kind of diggings. The congregation are dismissed, and the way's good to get his washpan." So suffice it to say that poor old George was not buried there, but taken from his rich hole, and a grave made for him high up on the mountain. Some amazing products were sold to the gullible Argonauts on the way to California. Take, for example, California gold grease, which sold for $10 a tin. It was advertised in Richmond, Indiana, Palladian, February 7, 1849. It said, once you located a likely hill of gold, you strip naked, rub the gold grease all over your body, and then roll down the hill. And the gold was stripped. That reminds me of that earlier tale of the Gilded Man called El Dorado. That whiskey slide down in Calaveras County, and Andy Carney, staggering drunk, stumbled into a deep prospect hole, slept there all night. When he awoke next morning, he found that his overnight floundering, trying to get out of this hole, had exposed a gold vein. Digging with a pocket knife, he filled that quart can with nuggets, and in 2 weeks, took out $70,000 in gold. Or if ingested for inflation, about $1 million. I bet that cured his hangover. At Columbia, a man named Holden pulled up a weed in his garden and found a $5,000 nugget tangled up. Even barbers did well. They shaved miners all day for $1, and then in the evening, they'd scrape up the whiskers and pan out the gold. See, Dr. Thaddeus Hilder, in May 1850, was too lazy to wash out and scrub his inexpressibles. So he tied his drawers to a limb over a stream, figuring that the current would do the job. Much to his delight, when he came out to get his drawers in the morning, he found that they were gold-plated. I doubt that's true. Despite the less electricity of the words and the amazing luck associated with their discoveries, what I most admire about the Argonauts is that they kept diaries and wrote letters under incredibly difficult physical circumstances. There were no cell phones, text messaging services, no YouTube, Twitters, emails, wikis, or blogs back then, of course. HMT Powell, the author of the great book, The Santa Fe Trail, provides us with a wonderful word picture with his diary entry for April 15, 1851. He said, hands blistered, arms and ankles skinned and sore all over, back almost broke, very hot at work, in a perfect bath of perspiration all the time, and at the same time my feet were cold from standing in icy water. Yet he had the energy to make a diary entry with that blistered hand and skinned arm, probably by the light of a campfire. I wouldn't be able to do that. It's pretty amazing. But you can visualize him when he scrawled into his diary the following month. Peck, peck, dig, dig, shovel, shovel all day. I'm almost dead with fatigue. I still had not reached the gold vein. A week later, on April 30th, an exhausted pal made this entry. I have determined to abandon mining. I find I cannot stand it. I ache in every fiber of my frame. But it's our good fortune that the gold rush took place when so many people did keep journals and wrote detailed letters. Because this was such a remarkable affair, the journal keepers made sure their leather-bound books survived. Back home, the recipients of letters from the gold fields prized them as a bridge across thousands of miles. Families and friends read and reread these letters. Sometimes they were published in the local newspaper. When the mail arrived in the gold camp, every miner anxiously hoped a letter from a spouse or a parent awaited them. Homesick and tired, these letters gave them strength and comfort. Another miner, so homesick that he paid money to see a woman holding a baby. Bret Hart, in his immortal story, The Luck of Roaring Camp, wrote movingly how the presence of an orphan baby, the son of a prostitute, made rough men take baths, boil their shirts, and wash their language. Clergyman turned gold hunter Daniel Woods told movingly of his high expectation upon hearing that he received mail in such a crushing despair of opening the pioneer's version of junk mail. He said, it's about 7 months since my last letter from my family. Notice that he's a clergyman, went off to the gold fields looking for gold. My feeling may be thus imagined. Late yesterday afternoon, I heard that there were letters for me at Fremont's camp, 8 miles distance over the mountains. Although suffering greatly from blistered feet, I started early this morning after passing a sleepless night in expectation. Alas, what was my disappointment at finding my letters were from San Francisco soliciting the votes of a particular candidate. Mayor Taylor, a journalist and author of the best-known Gold Rush book, El Dorado, or Adventures in the Path of Empire, went through 45 different editions, still in print today, gave us a memorable account of the importance of mail from home. Writing in 1849, Taylor noted the anxiety created when steamers arrived in San Francisco without bringing mail. And the locals became so anxious that they planned a riot, and as he called it, an indignation meeting. Finally, on the last day of October, the steamship Panama came in, bringing the mail for July, August, and September, all at once. 37 mail bags were hauled up the little post office that night, and the 8 clerks were astounded by the receipt of 45,000 letters. And there's a great lithograph, too, showing these people in line, and some other enterprising people would make money by saying, "I'll stand in line for you," or "I got some pies to sell you," or "How would you like to buy some coffee? So, you know, get in Starbucks." California's eager to learn the national hometown news also prized newspapers imported from the States and Europe almost as much as the letters. Bayard Taylor tells us about a man who arrived in San Francisco from New York with a load of 1,500 newspapers and sold them for a dollar piece within 2 hours. Taylor, seeing this, went back to his own valise and brought out his newspapers and said he had sold them all within an hour for a 4,000% profit. Not bad. The topic of lack of women and their civilizing effect, however, was a topic of frequent concern. Perhaps the most bizarre account of making do appears in John Letts' California Illustrated. It said at a certain point in the mineral regions, part of a lady's hat was discovered, which caused so much excitement and joy, it was immediately decided to have a ball in honor of the event. Invitations were immediately distributed throughout the country. On the appointed day, 300 miners assembled, each dressed in a flannel shirt and accompanied by a bottle of brandy. An exact spot was driven a stick 5 feet on the top of which was placed the hat. And around it was wrapped a flannel blanket that was made to represent as nearly as possible a female form. By the side of it was placed a miner's cradle or machine in which was placed a smoked ham wrapped in a blanket. I think they're trying to simulate a little baby. At the close of each dance, the president of the meeting would rock the cradle while the secretary would pour a bottle of brandy down the dress back of the lady's neck. The ball lasted 2 days, and at the end of which time, the ground was surveyed into town lots and called the city of Auburn. So when you return home, go through Auburn and think about this lady's hat. The scene of Stanley Wilson, in her beautiful recollection, described a ball right here in neighboring Nevada City, where there are 12 ladies and about 300 guys. To cope with the shortage of the fair sex, a number of men tied handkerchiefs around their arms and airily assumed the character of ballroom bells. She happily reported every lady was overwhelmed with attention. She didn't report, however, about the guys that had the handkerchiefs around them. So. Perhaps it's no accident, too, that the most famous play about the gold rush is called A Live Woman in the Mines, written by Grasshouse's Alonzo Delano. Notice the word live. So Sam Clemens, in his classic book, Roughing It, related the poignant and moving story. He said, in those days, miners would flock in crowds to catch a glimpse of that rare and blessed spectacle, a woman. Old inhabitants tell how in a certain camp, the news went abroad early in the morning that a woman was come. They had seen a calico dress hanging out of a wagon down at the camping ground, sure sign of immigrants over the overland plains. Everyone went down there and a shout went up when an actual bona fide dress was found fluttering in the wind. A male immigrant was visible. The miner said, "Fetch her out." He said, "It's my wife, gentlemen. She is very sick. We were robbed of money, provisions, everything by the Indians. We want to rest. Fetch her out. We've got to see her." "But gentlemen, the poor thing, she's, fetch her out." He fetched her out and they swung their hats and set up 3 rousing cheers. And then they crowded around and gazed at her and touched her dress and listened to her voice with the look of the men who had listened to a memory rather than a present reality. Next, they collected $2,500 in gold and gave it to the man. Swung their hats again, gave 3 more cheers, and went home satisfied. That's not the While the presence of women exerted a powerful influence on the miners, it's also so fascinating that you see how they did economically. And I'm not talking about the Daughters of Joy. I'll give you 2-3 instances. A letter I recently acquired was written by none other than Mrs. Sam Brandon. And her husband was the one that scuttled Sutter's plan, scuttled Marshall's plan by going into San Francisco saying, "Go, go, go." on the American River. So she was writing her sister on September 2nd, 1848. Said, "We are living in one of the most healthy places in the world, and I am quite content and happy for the time being. That is until we make our fortunes, but we would never think of settling here for life. I think in 2 or 3 years we'll find us in New York, where we can enjoy life. That is if we have good luck as at present. But now is the time for making money. You hardly believe me when I tell you that this summer, in a little more than 3 months, I have cleared $500 by making and getting made cheap clothing, pants and shirts, such as you would get in New York 25 cents for making. I am getting $1.50, and they have only one pocket in them. Women can make 5 or 6 pair a day." I love that expression. Now is the time for making money. The aforementioned Lucina Wilson beautifully encapsulates the opportunity that awaited those provided just the basics. She arrived with her husband and family via the Overland Route. Lucina recalled in an article for San Francisco Argonaut, she said, "It's almost dusk on the last day of September 1849, but we reached the end of our journey. My poor tired babies were asleep in the mattress at the bottom of the wagon. The night before, I cooked my supper on the campfire as usual, when a hungry miner, attracted to the unusual sight of a woman, said to me, 'I'll give you $5, ma'am, for one of them biscuits.' Sounded like a fortune to me," she said, "and I looked to see if he really meant it. And as I hesitated, he repeated his offer and said he would give me $10 for bread made by a woman, and laid the shiny gold piece in my hand." An enterprising woman from Marysville put an advertisement in the local newspaper from 1849. The headline was, "A Husband Wanted," by a lady who can wash, cook, scour, sew, milk, spin, weave, hoe, can't plow, cut wood, make fires, feed the pigs, raise chickens, rock the cradle, gold rocker, I thank you, sir, saw planks, drive nails, etc., etc. Could read, as you can see, can write. Could once dance, can ride a horse, a donkey, or oxen. Besides a great many things too numerous to be named here. Now for her terms. Her age is none of your business. She is neither handsome nor a fright. Yet an old man need not apply. Nor any who have had a little more education than she has, and a great deal more gold. For there must be $20,000 settled on her before she will bind herself to perform all of the above. Address Dorothy Spraggs. Send your real name, P.O. Box, Marysville. Some historians think this is the first personal ad ever issued in California history. Actually, I did some research. It's published in a fictional work by Samuel P. Avery called Mrs. Partington's Carpet Bag of Fun. The one thing to keep in mind, though, when men did write home, there was a certain amount of self-censorship, not wishing to reveal anything that they did. Who's going to write their mother and say, "Gee, I was with a whore last night," or drunk? So when it came to drinking and gambling and, yes, whoring, it was always, "Look at what the other guy is doing." Many wrote of the gambling saloon, said that they entered merely as observers and never took a chance at the Ware or Monte tables or drank whiskey. Charles Ross Park, for example, in his diary, self-righteously wrote, "During all this excitement, apparent chance to get rich, I never made a single bet or took a chance." In contrast, Alonzo Delano of Grass Valley, better known as Old Bach, modestly noted, "I haven't got to drinking, stealing, or gambling yet, but expect to commence in a day or two." He went on to say, had Milton lived now, he would have placed the scene of the great combat in California. At all events, his devils would have found plenty of ammunition here. The authors of that great classic, The Annals of San Francisco, set the record straight. They said the gambling halls were accordingly crowded with a motley crew, drank, swore, and gained to their heart's content. Everybody did so. Everybody did so. Gambling was a peculiar feature at that time. It was amusement, the grand occupation of many classes, apparently the life and soul of California. And since tomorrow is the Sabbath, Sunday, not all of you will be going to church here, how did the miners spend that day? Some listened to a minister, others read their Bibles, still others wrote home or made those diary entries. On the other hand, Hinton Helper, author of The Land of Gold, wrote, "The Sabbath in California is kept, when kept at all, as a day of hilarity and bacchanalian sports, rather than as a season of holy meditation. a religious devotion, horse racing, cockfighting, card playing, theatrical performances, and other elegant amusements are freely engaged in on this day. Drinking and gambling, of course, brings to mind what was the health like of these gold seekers. Accidents, fights, and exposures to elements sap their strength and kill more than one gold hunter. Poor diets, which consisted of tobacco, coffee, and flapjacks, led to numerous cases of what was called land scurvy and other reducing complaints. I won't mention after dinner here. A common cure for land scurvy was to bury you up to your chin. And one poor bloke I read about, actually, they buried him right next to some wild onions that were just about ready to ripen, able to turn and eat them, got cured. Apparently, they had vitamin C. So, Canadian William Perkins wrote in his journal of another problem peculiar in the winter months. He said, "There's not much sickness except that produced by intemperance. The most common and fatal result, however, is of drunkenness, is falling in one of the thousands of deep pits dug during the summer by the miners. And now, full of water, scarcely a week passes when two or three bodies are not fished out from one of these mining holes." You can imagine, just walking along after having one too many, whoops, never heard from again. Published books had a profound effect on those contemplating a trip to the Golden Land, and they flooded the market, packed with some absolutely breathtaking descriptions of life in the diggings. Mayor Taylor's El Dorado stands as my favorite, closely followed by John David Borthwick's 3 Years in California and William Shaw's Golden Dreams and Waking Realities. Writing my bibliography, I examined over 700 books and pamphlets about the gold rush. Along the way, some titles caught my eye more than others, and here are some of my choicest works. The best title for a gold rush book is I Hear the Hogs in My Kitchen by Mary Ballou. Best opening line is appeared in Chauncey Canfield's brilliantly told account, The Diary of a 49er. He said, "The pork I brought in town last night is the stinkingest salt junk ever brought around Cape Horn." I might point out that some historians take this work as fiction, as still as a work of fact. Best one-liner that was written by the great gold rush artist John David Borthwick. He said, "While in San Francisco, he observed people live more there in a week than they would a year in most other places." I think this could apply to Grass Valley just as well. Hinton Helper's book, The Land of Gold, Reality versus Fiction, is famous for bashing California, but it also has the best quote of them all. He said, "I have seen purer liquors, better cigars, finer tobacco, truer guns and pistols, larger dirks and booing knives, and prettier horses here than in any other place I have ever visited. It is my unbiased opinion that California can and does furnish the best bad things that are obtainable in America." Still the case today. Most unusual author's name. Gold Rush produced a fine series of satirical works authored by the likes of Jeremiah Saddlebags, Alfred Crokill, Abraham Crackenfuss, J. Sterling Coyne, Ralph Raven, Long Tom, Jonathan Sopwell, S. E. Peppergrass, F. A. Hotcorn, and Tom Plum. But the one that took the case for me was the author of Orifodina. This is the first novel about the gold rush, and the author's name on the title page is Cantel L. Bigley. I never thought much about this until I saw the copy at the Huntington Library. It was inscribed, "Cantel a Big Lie, George Washington Peck." The best name for a mining company was the Grand Auriferous, Sculptiferous, Acidiferous, Californian Bamboozle Company. And as a bibliographer Wright Howes notes, it's no doubt represented a whale, a victim of fraudulent mining scheme. Close second, though, is the great Do and Diddle Gold, Silver, Copper, and Brass Smash, Ash, and Crash Company. The company's holdings were located in the Mosquito and the Torpedo districts of California. I have no idea. The most improbable guidebook to the gold fields was published in 1849. It's called Aerial Navigation, Practicability of Traveling Pleasantly and Safely from New York to California in 3 days, fully demonstrated, full description of a perfect aerial locomotive. It was published by Rufus Porter. You say, okay, this guy's a charlatan, but he was editor of none other than the Scientific American. We had a certain amount of cachet. Artists, of course, could not resist poking fun at the gold fever. My favorite illustration was by Nathan Currier, later of Currier and Eyes fame. It bears the title, The Way They Go to California. In this 1849 lithograph, Currier pokes fun at Rufus Porter's guidebook. He depicts a crowded wharf where eager gold seekers are madly falling in the water trying to get aboard a gold rush-bound ship. The scene in the sky above, though, would have made Jules Verne proud. On one side, it shows the Mystery of Gold lightly straddling a rocket. And I think it's the first example I've seen in this country of rocket travel. On the other side, he drew Rufus Porter's aerial locomotive that promised to take you to California in 3 days for only $30. And a man parachuting from a craft, I think he must have had second thought. But I think this is the first example of skydiving in California. Another print was called the Grand Patent India Rubber Aerial Railway in California. And the concept of this was a giant rubber band would be stretched as far as it would go, be loaded with passengers, and somebody would cut it and would sling everybody across the pond to California.
You want to do that?
They tried that in Cornwall to get you at least to the Atlantic coast. So, but in documenting these flush times, we cannot overlook music as demonstrated by the remarkable examples of sheet music with songs like the California Quickstep, Gold Fever Gallop, and California Polka. And can you imagine what it was like to walk down the street here, like in Grass Valley, or some of the mining camps like Red Dog, Gouge Eye, Murderer's Bar, Sucker's Flat, Ladies' Crevice, Skunk's Misery, Jackass Gulch. Wonderful names. These guys had imagination. But just sound effects alone must have been incredible. Benjamin Avery, upon seeing this area for the first time in Grass Valley, wrote, "At night the tents shone through the pines like great transparencies, and the sound of laughter, shouting, fiddling, and singing startled the soul. It was a wild and wonderful scene. Owners of great gambling saloons seemingly spared no expense in creating a heady atmosphere, even though the structure itself was no more than a large tent. Music was a great enticement, and all kinds of bands and varieties of instruments could be found. Maybe some of our choir would have made a fortune back then. Gambling saloon musicians made upwards of an ounce of gold per performance." According to the Marysville Directory of 1856, musical talent commanded the most utopian prices. Any amateur that could torture hair and cat gut into any consecutive sounds reasonably endurable found the gambling saloons a much more remunerative field for his labor than the richest laden placer. A Swiss lady playing an organ grinder in the gambling saloons made $4,000 in a month. Adjusted for inflation, that's about $100,000. Quality, as related by Bayard Taylor, was another manner. He said the mingling of the sounds in one forward, ear-splitting, grazing chaos would drive frantic a man of delicate nerve. Out in the wilderness and in the camps, however, the miners experienced less sophisticated, more spontaneous form of musical entertainment. Luther Schaefer, throughout his diary, paints a memorable picture. Around campfires or in their tents and log cabins, gold hunters would engage in singing hymns or favorite songs depending on their country of origin. Homesick miners became teary-eyed when hearing familiar songs. Their singing would sometimes counteract the screams of firing a gun and other hideous noises emanated out of these camps. The jumping town of Rough and Ready, which is not too far from here, Schaefer noted how a group of Frenchmen pitched their tents nearby and applied with liquor would make the woods re-echo with French songs and boisterous merriment. On a hill above old Hangtown, Placerville, a man with his bugle played the Star Spangled Banner. The bend of Placerville, you know, it's in a valley. You can imagine how that sound just bounced off the hills there. Schaefer, in search of better prospects, moved to Grass Valley and took with him his music. In April 1851, he recalled how his casual campfire inspired one of his companions to propose putting on a concert for the benefit of Grass Valley. With grand enthusiasm, these rough miners plunged into their work. Lacking a printing press, they wrote out their programs and posted them throughout the towns, advertising great vocal and instrumental concert by the Grass Valley Minstrels. Cards of admission only 50 cents. The choicest gems from the most popular operas will be performed. Ladies, of course, will be free. On Monday evening, April 7th, 1851, before a packed house, the Grass Valley Minstrels gave their one and only concert. Minstrels consisted of two professional musicians, a dentist, a banker, and Schaefer. Began, though, rather inauspiciously, as Schaefer going on stage, can imagine coming up something like this, tripped and fell, causing everyone else to fall over it. After much laughter, the musicians regained their composure and played and sang away. He said the violin shrieked, The guitar was out of tune, the hideous bones rattled, the abominable triangle gave forth about as sweet a music as a tin pan, and the flute chimed in. When the curtain finally rang down, the thunderous applause rewarded them. Schaefer, with justifiable pride, noted that their concert was long remembered in the Grass Valley area. So, as you climb into your comfortable bed tonight, think what it was like back in those roaring days. Stephen Massif, the great composer and vocalist, secured a room in a brand new city hotel and left us with this colorful picture. Said, I think mine was a corner bunk. The heat was insufferable, mosquitoes buzzing about, and with their slow and shrill attendance, fleas and bed bugs came in myriads to greet and congratulate me upon my arrival. Scratching and itching, itching and scratching, kept me pretty well awake all night, and then the stifled smell, the noise inside and out, the swearing and snoring of occupants. Keep in mind, you have 100 guys all packed together, no separate beds, laying on dirt floors. The barking of the dogs, the leavings of numerous trains of mules and donkeys outside, the cries of children rendered the scene perfect pandemonium. And to crown the whole, just as I managed to drop off into a doze, I felt a heavy bump against the slender door that screened me from the street, when to my astonishment, the head of a big ox presented itself and with its cold and moist snout commenced rubbing against my knee. As you remember the 49ers, I hope you'll agree that James Marshall's discovery produced not only treasure in the form of golden nuggets, but also treasure in the form of words and pictures. I will conclude with my favorite passage from those rambunctious days. The best happy ending experienced by a gold seeker. Appeared in a guidebook by Edmund Bryant, and in which he quoted a newspaper account from the Boston Chronotype. He said, a man returned to California with gold in the amount of $64,000. When he deposited them, which he deposited in one of the mints, he took off his old threadbare unmentionables and was about to throw them away, but his wife, a good prudent woman, laid hold of them and with a trifling effort took $23,000 worth of gold dust out of them. In reading these accounts, too, what struck me, too, is that when people return back home, they miss California. They miss the electricity. They miss that. No one says no environment. Schaefer, close of his book, wrote, the voyage was over. My spirits were weighed down with uncontrollable melancholy. I wish I was back in California. Or is landing in San Francisco instead of New York. Dame Shirley, upon leaving the gold country, lamented, my heart is heavy at the thought of parting forever from this place. I like this wild and barbarous life. I leave it with regret. So thank you for indulging me. I just love these gold seekers and their words. I hope you got a little something out of sharing this with you tonight, and just to have you have a great time here in this heart of the gold country. Thank you.